You're listening to the Mindful Public Safety Podcast, hosted by the Center for Mindfulness and Public Safety, where you'll hear conversations and insights from public safety professionals and those who train and support them. To learn more about CMPS training programs, visit mindfulpublicsafety.org.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another session on day six of the Global First Responder Resilience Summit. My name is Richard Gerling, and I'll be your co-host for this session. Today's theme is Leading Resilient Cultures. And I'm pleased to be here with Chief Ryan Johansson of the San Bruno, California Police Department. Ryan, thanks so much for being here with us today.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you for having me, Rich.
Absolutely. So, Ryan, I'm going to start out by reading your bio. And I know that often is sort of uncomfortable, but it's helpful just to set the stage so folks know kind of where you come from. So Ryan's bio. So Chief Johansson currently serves as the Chief of Police for the City of San Bruno in the San Francisco Bay Area. Ryan is a longstanding mindfulness and meditation practitioner and coach, and he has worked hard to bring the value of these practices to the police department's wellness efforts. While Ryan and his staff have worked toward this objective from multiple directions, the primary focus has been on integration into the department's culture and social identity. Ryan possesses a Bachelor of Applied Science degree in Law Enforcement Management, and he's currently enrolled in the Masters of Homeland Defense and Security program at the Naval Postgraduate School Center for Homeland Defense and Security. I'm stoked that you're in that master's program. That's fantastic. That is a phenomenal learning journey. I'm excited for you. Look forward to hearing more about it.
Yeah, it's been a huge challenge already, but it's I'm learning so much right out of the gate. I'm very fortunate to have been invited into it.
Yeah, there's some really great staff there, and I'm sure your classmates are pretty phenomenal folks too. And this is a good conversation maybe to have with them as well as we talk about leading resilience and what does that look like. So, Ryan, we've worked together before. We've trained together. I call you a friend, and I'm just really privileged to be here and have this conversation with you. And as we get started, what I would like to ask you to do is just kind of frame your story in whatever way feels right in this moment, but just kind of tell us about, Ryan, tell us about how you got started in law enforcement, what the arc of your career has looked like to date, and a little bit about what it's like to be a chief of police.
Yeah, I can certainly try. And I think that rather than reading off some sort of a resume that would be unimpressive to most, I think it might be better to just kind of characterize my explanation by the topic of our conversation here today a little bit. So I was a little bit late to the party in terms of law enforcement. I had a life before deciding to become a cop. Got out of college and started a couple of businesses right out of the gate and was enjoying that, relatively successful, but really, like most people would say, just kind of lacked that deep-rooted sense of meaning that I was looking for out of how I was spending so many hours of my life. And that ultimately drew me to law enforcement. I don't really remember how. I just remember showing up at Balboa Park in San Diego to take a written test for the San Diego Police Department. And 30 days later, I was in the police academy, and the rest is sort of history, as they say, right? But in terms of some context for this mindfulness journey and how we all end up where we're at, you know, as is so often the case, necessity was sort of the mother of invention for me. And I had a little bit of a meditation practice that I developed early on in life. My father died of Lou Gehrig's disease when I was 14 years old and the oldest of five kids. And I was introduced through a friend of my dad's to the idea of just kind of being able to quiet my mind and center myself with no real formal practice when I was young. And then in my first year with the San Diego Police Department, as is the case with so many of us, I was involved in a pretty hairy officer-involved shooting and really wasn't sure what to do with that, right? I'm at the station following my interviews and I have the kind of the good old boy crew grabbing onto me, ready to do what all too often happens, right? Call me out to the bar and throw down a bunch of beers and talk about how I've somehow done society a favor by being involved in this incident. And I was very fortunate to have one of my field training officers from, you know, just a number of months prior, had heard what happened from another subdivision of San Diego PD and showed up at the police department literally as I'm on my way out the door to go, you know, have choir practice, and snatches me up and says, yeah, there'll be a day for that, but today isn't it. And this guy instead took me out and explained that the coping mechanisms I established in that first 24 to 48 hours were likely to become the ones I fell back on for the many years of sort of strengthening myself from that experience that were sure to follow. And I don't think he had a formal mindfulness practice by today's definitions. You know, we're talking about almost 20 years ago now. But he was took me to the beach and was really clear that we were going to actually think about and discuss what had occurred, discuss how I internally processed it as an individual, not as this person I thought I became when I put on the uniform. And boy, it proved invaluable, right? Like I said, I got to the party a little late. I was already married. I already had two young children. And the last thing I wanted to do was bring this experience home in a negative way. And don't get me wrong, there have been growing pains over the years from that experience. And I went through many of the same things so many do after an experience like that. But I feel like I was equipped to process them in a very different fashion because of the incredible act of compassion of this individual who not only took it upon himself to train me, but then, you know, took the time to leave his work and come and grab me at such a pivotal moment. You know, shortly after that, I spent a couple of years in San Diego, transferred to the San Bruno Police Department. My wife was from the San Francisco Bay Area, so it was kind of a natural progression for us and a place where we would rather have sort of raised our kids, and ended up with San Bruno. And San Bruno immediately presented an awesome opportunity because with San Diego, we're, you know, some 3,000 plus police officers, and it's really easy to just kind of get lost in the shuffle, and cultural identity is all over the place in a department that big. But then I come to San Bruno where we have 50 cops, and we're all intimately involved with one another, and the ability to sort of impact and affect culture is evident every day. And we're almost reinventing it on a daily basis through our actions and the way we interact with one another. And right away, I saw this is a great opportunity to sort of share what was shared with me and see what it can do for people long-term in their careers. And I was blessed with a number of administrators who were willing to grant me the latitude to bring some of these practices into the police department well before I was the chief. And I think we've seen that over time, that integration has, as I'm sure we'll talk about today, kind of become a part of our social identity, who we see ourselves as, both in relation to each other and in relation to other police officers and other police departments, sort of a source of pride. And so coming full circle, it's phenomenal now to be in a position where, by the graces of a wonderful city manager who puts a lot of confidence in me, we've been able to institute new policies, procedures, and programs almost overnight and not be so afraid of failure and instead be excited about possibility and try new things. And when they don't work, move on to the new thing with not being any worse for the wear. So that's kind of a long-winded way of maybe describing how I end up here talking to you today, Rich.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And I want to take an intentional moment and just to honor and acknowledge this mentor you had, this person who, you know, we'll just say took you to the sand of the beach and had a real conversation, right? And it's just amazing how many people out there can do that. And you take that small investment of time in that moment to share some wisdom. Fast forward 20 years, like, you know, and here's this guy who influenced the chief of police, right? I mean, it's powerful, absolutely powerful. And, you know, I'm guessing this person wasn't a police chief. I'm guessing, you know, they weren't like some senior, you know, tenured, ranked up individual. And yet we often think that those senior folks have the most influence, and many times they have the least. And so, yeah, I'm blown away by how you described that. And yeah, that's fantastic. And here you are now, you're a chief, and you talk about policies and procedures and programs and mindfulness and integration of mindfulness into the culture of the organization. Maybe it would be helpful for us, Ryan, if you could, in your own words, kind of describe how your organization views mindfulness, or even, you know, maybe be more nerd-like. How do y'all define it? What is it? And what does the integration look like? And why is it important?
Yeah. You know, first I should probably come right out and say that, like, for every other department that's trying to do this, it is a work in progress. I'm definitely not sitting before you today because I've figured out the magic pill and we're this perfectly mindful organization all the time. We're not. That we're in fact, I would say that it's our investment in the process and our understanding of the fact that sort of everything is experiential as a group that has brought us to where we're at. So we know we have a long way to go, but we're pretty committed to continuing down that path. And I think that that comes from the fact that if you can create those sort of early successes, right? We've been very blessed by, first of all, the 2.5-day intensive retreat that my department did with your group was incredibly powerful as, I think, an immersive introduction, right? Like, we had been talking about mindfulness and I had been modeling it, which I think there's some good conversation to be had around that concept, informal leadership and modeling, and how critical that was in shifting the culture prior to the immersive training. But the immersive training then gave this, brilliantly gave these little tidbits of practice that even the most cynical could take away, try when they were at their worst, and suddenly realize experientially the merits. And there was a tipping point there where we went from this being something our hippie chief does, and albeit them believing that it works based on my career path and my trajectory and kind of the way that I live my life, to something that, oh my goodness, this works. Like, yes, the science is powerful. And I know we're going to talk about how important it is to tie the science to this more like mystical belief system that sometimes sits in the periphery of mindfulness. But the experience was the big piece. As soon as they got to taste it, in whatever way they did, for many it was some really simplistic, like, you know, cops have trouble sleeping. We know that. And suddenly they had something they could do besides having an extra drink or just being frustrated by not sleeping, that they got to experience the difference in how they were able to get not only sleep, but higher quality sleep. And then I think we came back and integrated that with the science through, you know, I have sort of a passion for that biohacking world and the things that we can now measure to give you that feedback system that tells you this is working. And I think the end result is that not that everyone's practicing this every day in San Bruno, but they do believe in it and they do know that it works. And it's become a part of, again, our cultural identity, how we speak and how we act.
Yeah, that's great. You know, we've talked a lot about mindfulness over the years. And then, of course, we trained together in that intensive, you know, 2.5 days. And I love that you describe mindfulness as a work in progress, or that what you're doing is a work in progress, that there's no prescriptive, this is the way to do this. And being responsive to the nuances of your own organization, the nuances of the personalities that make up, you know, your officers and your leadership team, and that make up your community, and, you know, what your community needs from your folks. I think that, you know, maybe it's helpful for me to frame mindfulness, as we talked about it and as we've trained, is really nothing more than cultivating the skill of attention, just paying attention to our own experience and learning how to regulate it. And, you know, there's lots of definitions. You know, Jon Kabat-Zinn often talks about mindfulness as paying attention on purpose, right? Without you know, the natural judgment and emotional reactivity that can come with that. And so the science piece has been normalizing so much of the experience that comes from the occupational stress and trauma, as well as the trauma of life that your officers experience. And so normalizing the experience you had as a young police officer in San Diego after the officer involved shooting, normalizing, you know, the trauma that your folks deal with, that you learn about, that you have to lead them through, you have to lead that resilient culture. And so mindfulness allows us this framework to not only experience, this might sound strange, but to experience the trauma, but to be in it, to lean into it, and to perform our tradecraft. Right? To do our work, to do our job, said differently, and then to be accountable as individuals and accountable as a team, accountable as an organization, to move forward, to step into actionable interventions like psychotherapy and integrated medicine and, you know, social connection and mindful movement, fitness, nutrition, all these other things that come along with that. And so I'm curious about how your organization is pursuing some of these things. What are some experiments that have worked well? And even maybe what's one or two that maybe you've learned like, oh, we probably should have done that differently, or we're going to quit doing it that way and figure out what's a different way?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I would say in the things that are probably working the best have been almost individualizing this concept and this effort, trying to really focus on creating a very high sense of self-worth among the individuals in the organization, creating an environment that encourages and celebrates this individuality. And I think specifically because I have this underlying message to my folks that I don't want the you think you need to be when you put on a uniform to come to work. That whatever we did in this line of work that made us think that that's the answer is probably how we ended up down a dangerous path quite some time ago, probably before I was even around. And so changing that narrative to be that, no, I want the you that you are at home with your partner, with your kids, with your parents. I want that this job, this place to be a platform upon which you pursue the best possible version of yourself. And who you are, your experiences, your beliefs, all of that needs to permeate what you do when you're wearing this uniform. I find the greatest disconnect and the most problematic behavior comes when that stops. And even for myself, I know that the moments in my career I'm least proud of are those where I was trying to be what I thought this sort of uniform made me and what the world needed to see when I was wearing it, only to come full circle to realize that what the world really needs is a human being with a gigantic heart to wear that uniform, to look at every interaction as impacting personal individual lives. And I think that that all feeds into itself, right? So when we talk about policies, procedures, even coming in and doing small things like I eliminated an archaic tattoo policy that said that you can't have your tattoo showing when you're wearing a uniform. I eliminated the facial hair policy. I eliminated any policies that seem to have been previously tied to some sort of purpose, but for which me and my command staff with the best minds in our department couldn't articulate what that purpose really was. You know, whether it was hairstyles or just a certain type of uniform you had to wear, a way you had to look in order to encourage that self-expression through the medium of police work within the department. And I think the natural segue from that was to say that, okay, so now if you're allowed to be yourself, now how do we as an employer create an environment in which you are continuously improving yourself, however you define that? And the job provides perhaps the greatest possible set of opportunities of any profession I've ever considered to do that. It's a virtual nonstop course in personal development and improvement if it's seen that way. And if you embrace this growth mindset instead of sort of this fixed mindset. And mindfulness ended up almost accidentally becoming the best possible framework for that. Because it gave them a plan. Like, okay, I want to be the best me. What does that mean? I don't know how to be the best me when someone's screaming at me 6 ways from Sunday on the street and, you know, is calling out my family and being so, you know, hateful towards me. Well, mindfulness, in my opinion, is the mechanism through which to not only be able to survive that situation, but to thrive from it and become better as you come out the other side in terms of your resilience. And so I think that we started with this deep commitment to individuality and to allowing people to really come in and express who they are and what they want this job to mean. We stopped trying to define it with the mission and vision statement that was written by someone God knows how many years ago. And we invested in letting the line level folks rewrite that in their own words internally with no, hey, you have to write it a certain way that it's going to look great for the outside world. No, this is ours. Let's make it ours. Let's make it about who we want to be. And they came out with some miraculous things as to why they do this work. What is their why? What is their real motivational factor? And then we incorporated that into that sort of sense of being. And then I think the more practical side of that is once we had that kind of figured out, we then use that as a foundation upon which to rebuild almost everything else we do. So things like personnel evaluations are now completely centered around those things that are line level identified as being our purpose as a law enforcement organization, so that we're making an effort to quantify and measure the things that historically we've just said aren't, they're immeasurable. So why put them into an evaluation? Things like ensuring peace, you know, providing safety, being courageous. We're still working through trying to quantify what those things mean, but they are incorporated directly into how you're evaluated on your day-to-day performance. Wellness, even, like, we've basically, we call it our whole human approach to wellness, but our focus is that, yeah, wellness isn't about diet or exercise or mindfulness or clinician care, or it's about all of it. And so we have sort of this, you know, six-winged approach to wellness, and we've restructured our fitness incentive program that gave like a pay incentive for what before was literally like, can you touch your toes and can you walk 3 miles in, you know, 45 minutes? Then here you go, here's your extra pay, to a point-based system that grants rewards for activities in all of those six areas. So you get points for going to see a clinician about your mental health. You get points for going through a meditation practice. You get points for exercising, for embarking on a new diet, for hydrating properly, for sleeping at least 7 hours, kind of building the back-end systems to support all these things that we're espousing. So I that's probably a more information than you were looking for, but those are some of the things we've done that I think have worked. In terms of some things that maybe haven't worked, when we first came back from the 2.5-day intensive, my vision was that we're going to fully integrate mindfulness like overnight, man. We got it. Now they've been exposed to it. We got coaches certified, like, let's go. This is going to be a daily or weekly practice. And we set up a room for it and set up all the capabilities to do it. And I failed to recognize this very important sort of the value of this old adage, right? That culture eats policy for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, as they say, and that the process of integrating this into our identity and our culture was going to have to be much more involved. It was going to require a long-term commitment. And I think what I found kind of excitingly, but also a little bit embarrassing in hindsight not to have seen this, is that it needs to be by real conscious design. Like, there are right ways to seed a new belief system through a culture of people. And we did a lot of that using sort of the social identity framework. I know I've used that term a couple of times, right? But this idea that there are in-groups and out-groups throughout our world, and in law enforcement, boy, is that accurate. And if the change doesn't come from the in-group, it will never be embraced. I don't care how important it is or how compelling it is. And so we were able to identify ways to begin seeding this through the in-group and making it about elite performance. And about being the best you can be, about feeling better about who you are. And that seems to have been what's made the difference.
Yeah, it's really powerful. You know, it's really fascinating. There's so much remarkable scientific research around mindfulness in large populations. And then there's some really practical research outcomes around mindfulness among police officers that my team is responsible for some of that. And we have some other folks researching at University of Wisconsin and some other places now. And basically what we know is we can train mindfulness skills and we see some really great outcomes. You know, we see improved sleep, we see reduction in alcohol use, we see reduction in anger and aggression, improvements in compassion, you know, we could just say humanity, and a number of other things that are really, really phenomenal. And as chiefs, as community members, we're like, yes, please, we need that. And the really difficult part is that we cannot approach like the integration of mindfulness like we would approach the integration of body cameras, right? It's like, oh yeah, of course, this is easy. But let's just step 1, 2, and 3 and let's socialize this. Here's policy and boom, now even with some disgruntled folks, sometimes we'll eventually figure it out and we'll all wear body cameras and operate them and it's all good. Mindfulness isn't that way. It's going to look different in San Bruno than it's going to look in San Francisco than it's going to look in San Diego. And that's how actually it should be, because it comes back to what you talked about at the very beginning, which I really want to talk about some more. And that is this notion of individualization. And, you know, you framed your approach to leading people at the San Bruno Police Department in ways that really resonate with me and my background as a researcher, specifically around positive psychology and trauma. And the way you're approaching this, Ryan, is one of the most trauma-informed, or I'll even say more specifically, trauma-competent leadership strategies. Because what you're doing is you're giving your men and women in uniform a sense of self-worth, right? And a sense of, you know, in nerd terms, what we might refer to as agency. And with that agency, with that sense of self-worth, we can reframe our perspective and our relationship with occupational stress and trauma. And we can reframe our own experience and even resistance to things that maybe would normally create instant barriers. So for example, by simply training in some foundational skills that allow us to cultivate that sense of agency and cultivate the compassion and curiosity about the world around us and still be a badass, skillful police officer, we might have less resistance to the philosophical conversations around police reform. We might be able to hold the conversation when our community member or politician says, we're going to defund the police. We might be able to more compassionately listen and hear when we, especially guys like you and I who look like us, you know, are in conversation with our communities of color who talk about Black Lives Matter. And all sorts of social justice movements and efforts to create a more equitable society don't feel like a threat anymore. And that's incredibly powerful. So by resourcing our police officers with this sense of agency and the skill of understanding what their own experience is, even understanding their own bias that emerges, and to go, oh, that's interesting, I'm really uncomfortable, this is what I'm thinking about, but I can just let that sit. And I can still take in this information, and I can still show up with that vision and purpose that, as you've described, your folks got together and said, hey, chief, here's our purpose, right? I can hold that purpose and align my actions with that purpose and have my own values, my own political opinions, my own ways of voting, right? My own ideas. And maybe along the way, some of those things will evolve and shift, or maybe they won't, but I can still show up in my community with skillful performance. And sometimes we don't see how we encounter resistance, political or otherwise, as an actual performance issue. And it really is. So this authentic humanity that really grounds your culture is so critical. And as a sort of an amateur scientist and a researcher on a lab that looks at this stuff, I think it's the foundation for growing forward. And I chuckle a little bit, you know, we talked about you coming back from the immersion training. You're like, we're going to integrate this. We're going to do this. What we know is you can't just create a policy that says we're going to be a mindful police organization. Well, first of all, we don't know what that means. I mean, I'm not even sure what that means. And I've been doing this work a long time, but you know, it reminds me a little bit of Michael Pollan's work around, food, right? And for years, he's been writing about food and science. And he writes a lot about sort of the slow food movement and how food that is, we take time to prepare food. We take time and it takes hours maybe to cook certain meals. And as it turns out, they taste better. As it turns out, people want to eat them. As it turns out, they're actually better for us in the short run and the long run. And I think, you know, when you talked about this slow conscious design of whole human health, I think you're onto something, man. And I think it's, you know, I compare it with sort of the slow food movement and nutrition. But I think for sustainable change, it has to happen slowly. And that is how I see it. That's what you're experiencing and that's what you're leading. And it's difficult. There's no question. And it's difficult when you have this environment of occupational stress and trauma, and in this environment where your police officers will be trauma injured on the job. I mean, that's just what we know. It's what the data tell us. That's what the lived experience of the men and women who serve in this role tell us, is that trauma injury is something that's going to happen. And that impacts leadership too. That impacts our ability to be a follower. It impacts our ability to be a leader. And so with respect to trauma, what are your thoughts around your approach with this whole human health? What are some of the things that you're doing that you've seen be really effective in intervening with the cycles of trauma injury that happen among police officers in San Bruno?
That's a great question. And again, this is one of those where I have to be honest that we are on. This is very much a work in progress, mostly because we're discovering that we can leverage the insane amount of data that we compile now as a police department and some of the measurables that we've talked about here and in the past to queue up paying better attention to trauma, being better informed about trauma as an organization and being on top of it, and not to let the pitfalls that have traditionally plagued our you know, industry in general, the entire policing enterprise, get to us so much. You know, I think the classic example is the way we rush to help an officer when there's an obvious trauma that they've, you know, encountered in the line of work. And the most obvious is the officer-involved shooting, right? I mean, there's dozens and dozens of others, but that's maybe the most illustrative example here. And we're pretty good, and I use that term like kind of smirkingly, right? Like we're pretty good about at least providing some initial services. But traditionally, we're horrible about realizing the real nature of a trauma that severe and its long-term implications and the triggers that come up over the years, both known to the organization or should be, and the ones that are not, and staying on top of those and working through those. So, and just as a case of illustration, one of the things you ask, you know, what have we done that I recognize it's been really hard to do as a new incoming chief? Albeit I've been with the organization, you know, some 16 years before being chief, but nonetheless, as a new chief, is that you're inheriting some problems. And the fact is that we had some examples of officers that had experienced real significant trauma as a direct result of their commitment to our community and our department and their line of work that were never taken care of well before I was even working there, well before I had any real role in making sure that wasn't the case. And it seemed clear that one of the first things we need to do is sort of some housekeeping on those existing looming issues, because, you know, there's that old adage that, you know, what you do screams so loudly in my ears that I cannot hear what you say. And so I could pay all kinds of lip service to how much I care about these people. And then what the people are seeing is this example from however long ago of an officer that's in real, real suffering that is not being addressed or taken care of by the department. And figuring out how the line level is defining that not being taken care of is important, right? What I found is it's not that we're not offering services, right? That's what we've always done. We offered peer support and EAP. Of course, we did all that. It was what their perception was, that we weren't providing avenues out for this individual, or we weren't advocating to the city for maybe a psych-related retirement or something that was in that officer's better interest. And so the first thing that we did was we really took those issues on directly, and we're a relatively small department. So there were two that really needed to be addressed. And I think once they were, the action spoke louder than words among the line level that, oh, this command staff really does care about what this job can do to us and will make an effort to advocate for us on levels that we haven't seen before from prior administrations. And I think that once that was in place, it allowed them to accept our further actions as more genuine. Like, oh, they're installing a new program that tracks, you know, X number of days after traumatic experience in our CAD RMS and then has a, you know, a peer support level check-in. Now, instead of that being some stupid thing that they just think, oh, they're just trying to check a box, it's like, oh no, it's really clear that this chief, this administration, they really care about us and they're genuinely checking it and making sure that we know what services are available to us and really coming from that place of real compassion that we want a good, healthy individual and through that, a good, healthy police department. So I think that that was a really important piece, dealing with the issues that were inherited and then with the actions conveying that we were genuine. And then I would say that what's been nice that's followed after this slow process that you're talking about is that now the first sort of treatment we look for when we're experiencing a difficulty as an organization in most cases pertains to this concept of mindfulness, resiliency, and wellness. The door has been opened, so to speak. And now if someone goes, you know, over a cup of coffee to their beat partner and says, you know, man, I haven't slept in 3 days, really, graveyard's killing me, you know, my kids, I was super impatient with my kids today and that's not who I want to be. It's not just a venting session anymore. That peer is likely to make a suggestion in terms of treatment that is in line with these concepts and these principles and this sort of different way of thinking. And that seemed to really be the tipping point. Like it just, it's just kind of, I don't know how to describe it besides it's like becoming who we are. It's becoming how we treat things. And we could talk about COVID-19 in that respect for ages and how we've sort of addressed that internally, maybe differently than a lot of other organizations. But I think that hopefully that kind of answers your question about how we've integrated this.
Yeah, that's fantastic, Ryan. And one of the things that really sort of lands with me is you've described leading a resilient organization as a practice. It's a practice. It's not perfect, you know, and it's not prescriptive either. So there's no formula for how to do it right. And I think that's both the challenging part, but it's also the beautiful part. It's the part that allows you to really lead from the wisdom of your culture, the wisdom of the people that are on your, not just your command staff, but the wisdom of the men and women who make up your team, you know, in San Bruno. And you're not concerned, it seems like, about some prescriptive, perfect model of how to have a whole health approach to wellness. So that's really fantastic. I love that.
I'm not concerned about that in the least, to be honest, right? I think it's because we're pretty committed to these foundational values as being not so much a means to an end. They are the end. The end is that this is the right way to treat one another and the right way to act. So we're going to keep doing it. And for those who might, you know, not have yet seen the real world positive consequences of this type of approach, I mean, probably if you're to ask a dozen police chiefs right now what the top three things are plaguing them, I guarantee that recruitment's going to be somewhere in there, right? It's always been on the list. And now with the current environment and, you know, the new generation and the way that police are viewed, like it's incredibly difficult to staff your department with good quality people who want to do this job for the right reason. And it's not that we've been immune to that, but I have more lateral job applicants than our department has ever had, because the real world consequence of this type of a program is that my people are out there selling the department. My people are out there saying, oh, you want to do something different? We're different. You come over here. We're not doing things like that. You're not going to be treated that way. You're going to be treated very differently. Here's, you know, what we're doing to make sure you have a long, productive, healthy career. And so there are real world positive consequences to this beyond the like woo-woo, hey, you know, we're all sitting in the lotus position and look how, you know, woke we are. There's a lot more to this than that. And we're starting to see that manifest in these real world positive consequences that I'm super excited to, as time continues, to be able to share.
No, that's really great. I love that. I love how, you know, we might say how the marketplace has a voice, and that marketplace in this context is lateral officers who are like paying attention to what you're doing and want to be part of it. And that's a really intensive measure of success. So congratulations there. I want to speak to this woo-woo notion of sitting in a lotus position. And I will sit in a lotus position and meditate. And I'm not embarrassed by it. And I also know this, is that doing that when I was a police officer allowed me to be more skillful. And it allowed me to drive my vehicle safer and faster. It allowed me to make decisions more appropriately and faster. And I think that there's this idea that, you know, we all want to perform better, right? And we all want to be, especially when you start drawing in some of the toxic culture of policing, and some of the ways that we have, we've corrupted, maybe a strong word, we've kind of corrupted this notion of being a warrior. We're coming back to really what it means to be a warrior humanitarian with this approach that you have. And this idea of improving performance is that it starts internally, right? And the more I know myself, I mean, this is ancient wisdom. You know, the Greeks, for example, inscribed this above their, you know, above their community places and temples, you know, this notion of know thyself, right? And it's not just know thyself, but it's know thyself, accept thyself, right? Accept that, oh, wow, I'm really feeling distressed right now. And what's wrong with me? And then noticing the judgment that emerges around my own observation of self, and just to allow myself to be like, okay, I'm feeling melancholy, you know, and I just had this series of critical incidents, and I'm not sleeping and I'm irritated and you know, whatever it is, to go, that's normal. And to be accountable, because we've cultivated this sense of agency, this sense of individual identity that is important to you and your team and your men and women at San Bruno PD, I have the ability to take action with that and not just sit in it and not stew in it and not maladapt with my behavior as a result of feeling distressed, right? And so this ability to be in distress more skillfully is a performance outcome.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with everything you said. And I certainly don't mean to speak disparagingly about the idea of sitting, you know, in lotus position or anywhere else in terms of meditation. In fact, I think that one of the cultural shifts that we've enjoyed is the fact that, you know, I was an informal leader in my organization well before that leadership role was formalized. And I don't hesitate to sit and meditate in front of God and country. Like it's not something that bothers me because I'm hoping to dispel that sort of myth that this is somehow some sign of weakness and, or that it's odd or weird. I'm not embarrassed by it in the least because I credit it with almost everything good in my life centers around the fact that, I've cultivated this awareness, this sense of what I am, not being this physical body and not being this ego, but being this awareness of those things, this ability to observe those things and to consciously steer them in directions. And so I think that that's been really important to set the example, to say that, you know, no, this is absolutely about performance in my view, in many regards, in almost every regard, that's what this is about. And I think that, you know, if you can set that example and you continue to talk that talk and walk that walk, you know, my people can look at me and I'm by no stretch of the imagination perfect, but I do a lot. I have a lot going on. You know, I'm the chief. I own a business. I got a family. I volunteer in a number of capacities. I mean, I'm busy, but I'm not overly stressed. It's all about leveraging these practices, as you say, to be able to process adversity and stress. And it almost becomes a badge of honor that, you know, you're, instead of being ashamed of those traumas, you really can wear them as being a fundamental part of who you are today, because the outcropping of it has been positive and not negative. You're able to see that. I can honestly say that of all the traumatic experiences in my life, whether it's losing my father young, being in the shooting, losing family members, all the things we see in the line of work, SIDS cases and, you know, homicide, the whole nine yards, I would give back not a single one of them as I sit here today, because I'm able to understand that my healthy processing of those things is 100% why I'm where I'm at and I want to be where I'm at.
Well, and that's so powerful, Ryan, you know, and you just describing what post-traumatic growth looks like. And I think there's a real helpful message in that. And that's what we're trying to do with the conversations around resilience. And in particular, that's what we're trying to do with mindfulness, is to give some hope that there is a path forward and there's a way to move out of injury to the wisdom and insight that trauma provides us, and to get to a place of growth where we can look back and go, yeah, I hold the scars of that experience. And I still have grief. I still feel loss. And it has made me who I am. And I have agency. I have sense of self-worth, right? I mean, these are powerful principles that you're building as a foundation. And I want to thank you for that. And I also want to ask you two or three things that you might recommend to police leaders or community leaders that are out there watching our conversation today, or even one thing. You know, maybe you're a new chief of police somewhere and you're in the wellness conversation, and let's face it, it's overwhelming. What are some thoughts of wisdom that you might offer to that new chief?
Well, you know, far be it for me to tell anyone how to do their job. And like I said at the beginning, I certainly recognize that I'm in not a unique, but a pretty different environment that makes it a little bit easier for me to implement these kinds of changes than it might be for someone somewhere else, especially if you're a chief coming into an organization from the outside, or maybe even harder if you've been on the inside for a long time and this just isn't who you are. This might be an overly strong statement to make, but I really do kind of believe that this is not optional, for what it's worth. I think that this is the only way that we transcend the situation that we currently find ourselves in that none of us wants to be in. And so I would argue that you can't do this falsely within your organization. You can't implement this kind of cultural change if you don't believe in it. And so I would just challenge you to really explore it if this is not you. If you just think, man, this is so hard and I see the value, or my boss has asked me to implement this and I don't really know what to do with it, that take a deep dive from an explorative point of view and challenge it. Don't come in with this, you know, oh, of course this must work because Rich and Ryan say it does. Challenge it. I'd be surprised if you come in with an open but critical mind if you don't see some value here. And once you can see some value, even if it's only little bits of light in the beginning, then I think you can begin to affect this kind of change in an organization. But you can't affect it, as you said earlier, Rich, just because you come in and say, well, this is our new policy. Hey, we're going to be all about our people now. So here's this new policy. It's your actions are going to speak far louder than words. And so if this is something that you kind of know to be true intrinsically, and you're like me, I like to joke with you, Rich, that like the day I saw your cover picture on Mindful Magazine was like the day a new leaf turned for me, because I honestly felt like I wasn't alone. Like I thought, oh, here's me, this like meditator, this kind of Buddhist flow, different dude. And then here's, you know, the cop I am. And suddenly like there was permission to meld those. So if no one's given you that permission before and you do hold some of these beliefs, these tenets, like then let me be that person. Like I'm giving you permission. I promise that if you do it genuinely, the results will be absolutely phenomenal for you, for your people, for your organization, for your community. I mean, this reaches all the way across that whole platform. So if you have this inkling, chase it, be bold, believe in it, it works, it matters, you will be glad you did. And if you don't, please, please dive and explore it, because I don't know of another way to take care of your people the way that you are obligated to take care of your people.
Powerful words, Ryan. Thank you so much for your time. Yeah. And I, again, man, as a community member, not in your community, but just in America, so appreciative of your leadership efforts. And I look forward to more conversations in the future.
Rich, as always, it's a pleasure. And I really appreciate the opportunity to speak to the group here. Just the fact that they're attending, right, is just a huge boost for me to know that we're continuing to push the needle, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, thank you, sir. Appreciate your time.
Thank you, brother.
Thank you for listening to the Mindful Public Safety Podcast, hosted by the Center for Mindfulness and Public Safety. Video of these podcasts are also available. You'll find access information in the description. And learn more about CMPS training programs at mindfulpublicsafety.org. See you next time.